No matter how many times I hear that song, each time my heart feels both broken and broken wide open. Hallelujah. Glory to the Lord. Hallelujah indeed. That song is certainly worthy of such praise. So can I hear the word from the congregation? Hallelujah.
Hallelujah.
Such a moving, heart-gripping prayer of a song, and yet most of us are a little hesitant to really proclaim hallelujah. The sheer emotionality of it makes many of us uncomfortable. It draws to mind a caricature of one who has seen the light at some Christian revival, and indeed, it does proclaim a Hebraic translation, glory to the Lord. Hallelujah. One of the later verses of the song plays on that image. Yet no one, I think, that is familiar with Leonard Cohen's style of songwriting, a man who was raised as a Jew and later practiced Buddhism, would mistake his work for the easy platitudes and instant conversion euphoria of a revivalist. Cohen spent years, by his own account, crafting this song, with more than 10 verses, and then he added several more verses later on. By one account, there are at least 20 or more possible verses to this song. More than 45 artists have covered the song, and it has been sung on everything from concerts and TV shows to movies like Shrek, to commercials, to award shows. No brief emotional or spiritual flirtation is this song. And I think that part of the power of the song comes from Cohen's lifting up, perhaps almost unexpectedly, the range of emotions in the hallelujah. We've come to expect from religion an easy, sort of a feel-good form of hallelujah, a sigh of relief after the word and a tiring experience that we've made it through. Oh, thank God, hallelujah. Thank God that's over. Or we use hallelujah to stand in for a summed up joy. Hallelujah, my kid finally made it through school. And sometimes it's the affirmation of our lives that yes to the joy and gift of a new grandchild. Yet up against Cohen's sometimes bitter, mournful, and resigned hallelujah, our context for praising God or life itself is turned on its head. We might be mystified by the unexpected use of what we expect to be an upbeat and happy, or at least peaceful and holy hallelujah. Where did this baffling sense of it come from? So when I was doing clinical pastoral education, which is the chaplaincy requirement for Unitarian Universalist ministers and ministerial candidates, I was doing my work up at Sutter Roseville Hospital in a level 2 trauma center. And I was primarily assigned to the trauma neural intensive care and the ICU. And I did my best to minister to staff and patients and family and friends during death and life, trauma and acute illness. And over the course of 9 months, I never met anyone who expected the illness or trauma to have personally come upon them or their loved one. There were those that were there, of course, who had had long-term illnesses with perhaps a slow decline or a recent flare-up. But the initial illness or accident was never part of what most people expected for themselves or their loved ones. And I personally began to believe that the trauma or illness was not in and of itself unusual, though certainly heart-wrenching for those that were intimately involved. I realized that instead we will all experience illness and trauma at some point in our lives. We'll experience our own, we're going to experience that of the people around us on a really actually routine basis. We think of these things as unusual tragedies, and yet I was amazed by the number of days that we wake up overall without such an experience for ourselves or someone we love. The experience of illness, accident, and death are as much a part of life as health, love, and community. Experiences of heartache, sadness, and loss shape us into whole beings. And if we let them, holy beings. A paraphrased line from a Rumi poem implores us to look at the bandaged places, for that is where the light shines through. And in the responsive reading that we did this morning with Khalil Gibran, he put it this way: your joy is your sorrow unmasked. The self-same well from which your laughter rises was oftentimes filled with tears. Our places of brokenness do not transform themselves, however, effortlessly from heartache to wholeness. The in-between part looks like a whole lot of anger and despair and foot stomping and reconciling and trying to come to terms with what is chaotic and messy. And I don't know about you, but I hate it when life starts feeling chaotic and messy. We strive to make sense of things, to look for meaning in our suffering. And sorting through that meaning occurs whether we ascribe responsibility for the suffering to another or to ourselves, or simply to life itself. Viktor Frankl, a Holocaust survivor and the developer of a theory of meaning-making, logotherapy, put it this way. He felt meaning was a key element to the ability of our experience, to the ability to experience the self in an integrated and psychologically and spiritually healthy way. That the suffering itself gave rise to meaning when it was reflected upon. In the Hebrew biblical readings of David and Bathsheba, Samson and Delilah, we hear these echoed in the song Hallelujah. We find one man who appears to have brought on his own problems, King David, because he called for the death of another man, Uriah, who was Bathsheba's husband. And he essentially takes Bathsheba, the woman bathing on the roof that he has seen, and he rapes her, and he impregnates her. He kills off Uriah by sending him to the front lines of a war, and then he tries to disclaim his actions and justify them. He's baffled, according to the song. And later, in the same section of the biblical story, he knows that he has displeased the Lord. This king who has been having this happy relationship with God, this hallelujah relationship, got tempted to do something he knew was dishonorable and went against the laws that had been given by God. And yet, he's baffled. He's baffled by, like, how the heck did I get myself into this mess? I think we all at times find ourselves baffled by our own behavior. And we don't have to be followers of the Judaic Christian teaching to feel a similar guilt and bafflement when we do something, when our actions that might be less serious than David's have us straying from what we think of as our high ideals and our prior intentions of behavior. How many thousands of times might we have stretched the truth on a tax form or made an untrue claim about being late to work or to an appointment? How many times have we found ourselves in a situation where what we have said in a personal relationship or to peers has led others astray? How many times have we felt a slight sense of discomfort or guilt? I believe these are the broken and disclaimed parts of ourselves that Jung would call the shadow self. Now, with Samson and Delilah, we get a little bit variation on the broken theme. We might call Samson a fool for love. He knows from his past experiences interacting with Delilah that she's not proven herself trustworthy. In fact, over and over and over again, he keeps engaging with this woman, even though she keeps betraying him. He lets himself be vulnerable in love. And he is worn down by the entreaties that Delilah makes of him to know the secret to his strength. And yet he places his trust in love anyway, and he's betrayed. And I'd be willing to bet there's not an adult in the room that has not at some point felt betrayed by love. How many times have we invested our hearts and then felt like they were broken? The parent that abandons the child, The spouse that is unfaithful, the lovely or lover or family member who promised to stop drinking, all are betrayals. So too, though, are the repeated times that we promise to leave work on time to come home to someone waiting, or we spend a few extra dollars that we agreed to save for a budget, or we failed to follow through on a commitment to a group relying on us at church or elsewhere, and they need us to complete that task, and we have let them down. True, these aren't biblical proportions, but betrayals come in many forms. And I think that we perceive the size as important, but in truth, I believe that there's an allusion to that. Small hurts can be damaging. Acts of untruth or omitting words can add up over time. How then are we to deal with the repeated battering that life throws us when we find ourselves in a room that we know we've tread before? Can we accept our own sense of brokenness, perhaps even our rage? Or do we rush to try to change it or deny it, to minimize it, to make ourselves more comfortable? Do we go out and buy a new outfit, have a drink, reframe the story before we tell it to others so that we don't feel shame or guilt or just plain raw? When we've been dealt the blow of watching a loved one dying, or we've felt the sting of a friend that has shared a confidence that we felt they would keep, our hearts ache. What creates the anger, the bitterness, and the ache, however, is the memory of the love and the trust and the connection that had been present before. In order to experience a sense of betrayal, there first had to be a sense of trust. In order for that loss, there first had to be a sense of connection and love. Every cold hallelujah has within it the light and warmth of the whole and connected hallelujah. The complex call of our faith in life is trusting that we can not only do so, but must hold and honor both forms of that hallelujah. There's an amazing truth that often accompanies illness, pain, and trauma. I once met a woman in the ICU, and she was in excruciating pain. No matter how much medication she had been given, she just couldn't get comfortable. All of the medications weren't working, and I could literally see the blood vessels in her forehead through her thin, older skin throbbing with the pain that she was experiencing. And she gripped my hand, and she repeated over and over how much it hurt. And I identified myself as the chaplain on call, and she summoned her strength, and she looked me in the eyes, and she said, "I used to believe in God, but now I'm really not so sure." What honesty. I asked her if she had told this to the God that she used to believe in. And she seemed confused and surprised. I asked her if she had told this God that she believed in of her anger. And she said, "Why can I do that? Why would I do that?" And I said, "You can, because any God that you may or may not believe in should surely be worthy of hearing your whole truth and not just your worship and a portion of your truth." And I stayed with her and acknowledged her anger and her frustration, how alone she felt in her hurt and pain. And we wrote a prayer together based on that anger and that sense of betrayal, that sense of being abandoned by God, being abandoned by life. And several days later, when I checked back in with her and she was in much less pain, she thanked me for taking her words and turning them into a prayer. She hadn't thought that it was somehow appropriate to take one's anger and pain and call it a prayer. And yet, I believe that we all must do so at times. That is our authenticity and that is our truth. Just as it is our truth to sometimes be willing to be vulnerable with one another. This past winter, I went through a series of personal emergencies in a very short time period, and I was trying really hard to hold it all together and to keep engaging in a lot of my normal day-to-day activities. And a friend who I've known for a lot less time than some of my other closer friends, I've known him for perhaps about a year, looked at me and he called me on this behavior of mine, of trying to hold it all together. And he said, you know, it's really hard to get to know someone when they're trying to be perfect. And it's really hard to help someone when they're not willing to acknowledge the places of vulnerability where they don't have it all together. And I was called up short by that, and I said, you're absolutely right. Thank you so much for reminding me that it's fine to be broken and to share those hurt places with others. So whether or not you believe in a God above or within or simply in the holiness and wonder of life, whatever name or no name, we cannot take it in vain if we are being in our truth, whether it's the truth of what needs to be spoken, that thing that we're holding back and not saying, or the truth that we need to turn to one another and honor and be sincere about our reality and feelings. That truth-telling is holy. And we will stumble along the way. We will cause harm and pain, and at times we will feel angry and sad, as well as glad and full of love. And in each and every one of those places, my hope is that we will find wholeness and holiness in the hallelujah.